The co-director of the Montana Human Rights Network discusses race issues in the state on this Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne, and Capitol reporter Dan Boyce has our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition. We'll also tell you about a new program helping people find work near Great Falls. And in tonight's feature, reporter Edward O'Brien continues his two-part interview with state corrections officials about what can be done to stem problems associated with poverty and substance abuse. Martin Luther King Jr. Day provides a time for us to reflect on equality. The civil rights leader spent his life pursuing equal opportunity for all people, especially people of different racial backgrounds. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce speaks with co-director of the Montana Human Rights Network, Kim Abbott, about the state of race issues in Montana.
Kim Abbott describes today's racism as more nuanced, perhaps not as interpersonal as it was decades ago, with individuals blatantly being racist toward each other. She says the bigger race issues of today are more institutional.
You really need to look at equity in terms of opportunity, access to resources, and outcomes. And I think when you look at that, you can see areas where we have a lot of room to improve, and you can see areas where we're doing quite well.
An immigrant rights group is suing the Montana Highway Patrol, alleging racial discrimination, saying troopers have had a practice in place to check the immigration status of Latino drivers during routine traffic stops. The Highway Patrol hasn't commented on the suit, but Abbott says the concerns need to be taken seriously.
For folks to fully participate in their communities, they shouldn't have to live in fear of being targeted because of the color of their skin or their perceived ethnicity.
Otherwise, areas for improvement, she believes it can be easy in our culture to assume everyone starts out in life from the same place, but that's just not the case.
Sometimes you have people that start at the 50-yard line when other people are starting their own end zone, and I think we have to understand that to truly look at how we're doing.
She says you can apply this idea to Montana statistics like the academic achievement gap between minority students and their white counterparts, or the overrepresentation of minority groups in our correction system. She suggests we put more focus on solutions there.
Solutions that address the structures that might cause that in our state.
The achievement gap, the overrepresentation in our prisons, it's most apparent in Montana among Native Americans, our largest minority group at about 7% of our population. It's also regarding Native Americans Abbott believes the state has made some of its biggest strides, such as by instituting Indian education for all.
That basically says that all students in the state are going to be taught about the unique culture of American Indian people, the unique contributions that Indian people have made in the state of Montana, and also some of the challenges that are there.
She also applauds the state for electing a nearly proportional representation of Native Americans to our state legislature.
I think when you're looking at creating policies that address racial inequality, it's really important that you have representatives from the communities directly affected at the decision-making table. And in Montana, we're doing quite well there.
And she says that's something we can be proud of. Abbott just hopes it's not only on Martin Luther King Jr. Day that we think about these issues. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
And in other news from around the state, a civil rights organization suing Montana over its execution method says a recent Ohio execution illustrates the dangers of using untested drug combinations in lethal injections. Dennis McGuire gasped and snorted as he took 26 minutes to die in an execution last Thursday. Montana last year changed its lethal injection combination from 3 drugs to 2, though they are different drugs from those used in Ohio. But American Civil Liberties Union of Montana attorney Anna Conley says Montana's 2-drug combination also has not been tested, and nobody is sure how it will work. The ACLU is representing 2 death row inmates who are asking a judge to rule Montana's execution methods are unconstitutional. Montana Department of Corrections spokeswoman Linda Moudry says the state's execution protocol is distinct from that of other states. The state's recently appointed suicide review team has pledged to review every suicide that occurs in Montana in 2014 to try to determine the reason and recommend ways to reduce the state's suicide rate, which is nearly twice the national average. The team, appointed in November by Governor Steve Bullock, includes a pastor, psychologist, psychiatrist, sheriff, a schools official, and a social worker, along with Carl Rosten, the state's suicide prevention coordinator for the past 6 years. Rosten tells the Billings Gazette the team will meet 8 times each year and expects to review about 2 dozen suicides each month over the next 3 years. For more than three decades, Montana's suicide rate has ranked among the top five states in the nation. The state averaged 226 suicides in each of the last 3 years. Officials with the Gallatin National Forest Avalanche Center say a snowmobiler was lucky to have survived being buried under 4 feet of snow after triggering an avalanche near Cook City. The GNFAC says the man triggered the slide on Friday. Avalanche specialist Doug Chabot says fellow snowmobilers were able to dig the man out within 10 minutes and revive him with CPR. His avalanche report released this morning notes successful revival is very, very rare, and he told the Billings Gazette it was, quote, an incredible story of companion rescue, end quote. The man was able to ride back to Cook City on his snowmobile. His name was not released. The GNFAC says the avalanche broke 4 to 12 feet deep, was 500 feet wide, and ran 300 feet. A pickup truck went off an icy highway west of Big Fork, hit a guardrail, and rolled down an embankment into the Swan River, killing the 42-year-old driver. The Flathead County Sheriff's Office tells the Flathead Beacon the victim was James Lee Brown of Big Fork. The Montana Highway Patrol says Brown was driving on Montana Highway 209 at about 7:30 p.m. Saturday when he lost control of the pickup. He was not wearing a seatbelt, was thrown from the pickup, and died at the scene. A 22-year-old Kalispell man who was a passenger was taken to Kalispell Regional Medical Center with minor injuries. A 52-year-old Wolf Point woman died in a one-vehicle crash in Roosevelt County. The Montana Highway Patrol says the woman was traveling eastbound on BIA Route 1 at about 3 a.m. Friday when she failed to stop at the road's intersection with Montana Highway 13. The Great Falls Tribune reports her sport utility vehicle crossed both lanes of the highway and struck a wood post and some trees. The patrol says the woman was taken to the hospital in Wolf Point and then flown to the Billings Clinic, where she was pronounced dead. Her name hasn't been released. The number of livestock killed by wolves in Montana declined in 2013, but wildlife officials say that doesn't indicate a trend yet. In 2012, Montana ranchers filed 125 claims with the Department of Livestock's Livestock Loss Board, which paid out $102,700. Last year, the board received 96 claims and paid out just under $87,000. The 2013 payments for the first time included reimbursement for four cattle deaths in Park County attributed to a grizzly bear. Livestock Loss Program Coordinator George Edwards tells the Billings Gazette that he believes the increased hunting and trapping of wolves has helped livestock producers. USDA Wildlife Services State Director Don Stuber says he won't consider it a trend until depredations decrease for 3 to 5 consecutive years. Police in Kalispell have arrested a 25-year-old man on suspicion of stealing a framed military uniform from a store and trying to pawn a Purple Heart medal. Officers arrested Sean David Smith on Friday. Jail records indicate he also faces drug and forgery charges. Greg Smith, the owner of a frame store, said the shadow box containing his late brother's uniform and medals was taken on January 8th. Sean Smith, who is no relation to the store owner, was confirmed as a suspect after surveillance video showed him trying to pawn the Purple Heart. Two medals were recovered from Sean Smith, and police say others were turned in by anonymous associates of Smith. The shadow box, uniform, Bronze Star, and Purple Heart are still being sought. The Great Falls Job Service Center is offering a new program to help the unemployed find work and help employers find skilled workers. It's called the Family Economic Security Program, and coordinator Teresa Schreiner says the federal dollars provide training for those looking for work.
So we can provide training to these individuals. We have classes, we have all kinds of stuff, and we use the community at large to help with that training and those materials. We get them skilled and ready for the workforce, and then we help them get these jobs.
The program then matches workers with a pool of potential employers.
And what we do is we offer employers 100% coverage of wages for up to 700 hours. So ideally, we're looking at paying for up to 4 months of employment for these new job seekers, so that on-the-job cost that comes with training someone when they first come into the job, we're going to be paying for that.
Schreiner says both unemployed workers and employers interested in the program should contact the Great Falls Job Service.
That we're really looking to bolster the businesses that we have, those people that are looking to hire and maybe struggling financially. We offer part-time and full-time employment positions that we can fill, and we also offer temporary and permanent. So that's really effective, and the same with those job seekers. Maybe those people that are underemployed, not just the people that don't have jobs, we can get them enrolled in this program.
The program services six counties: Cascade, Shodo, Teton, Ponderay, Glacier, and Toole. This has been a busy time at the Montana Department of Corrections. Agency officials say they're working on a variety of projects and initiatives while at the same time maintaining day-to-day operations. In this final segment of a two-part series, Edward O'Brien speaks with Corrections Director Mike Bautista and Department of Corrections American Indian Liaison Harlan Trombley about a variety of topics, including what, if anything, can be done to stem problems associated with poverty and high drug and alcohol abuse rates.
Certainly there are opportunities on the front end in terms of early education, in terms of a lot of positive things that is being done around the state when children are young to maybe make a difference. But I think just in terms of the correctional system, I think the challenge for us and the biggest priority that we have going is finding a way to help both native and non-native offenders be successful when they reenter communities. It's estimated that 93% to 97% will come back to communities. So it's our goal to try and help them be successful. That requires a holistic approach where they learn how to make good decisions. We help them with critical thinking. We help them, you know, learn how to be employable. We help them with housing, all those things that would lead to successful reentry into our communities. That's probably our biggest challenge, but the most exciting challenge that we have.
Let's talk a little bit about staffing. 91.8% of corrections employees are Caucasian, 1.1% American Indian, 0.4% African American, 1.2% Hispanic, 0.3% Asian, and a not specified 5.2%. When Native people make up 17% of the total number of offenders within the department, it seems like there's a real discrepancy there. How come?
You know, it's interesting. That's something that we're trying to figure out. We have historically attended job fairs, been in colleges and university campuses, actually talking to Native Americans about employment opportunities within the department. For some reason, we are not getting the number of applicants that we had hoped, but it's an area that I think that we can continue to try and improve on. I really don't know the answer to that. Part of it may lie with many of the opportunities that the department has are outside of the reservation. So I don't know whether that it's an issue of people not wanting to leave their home for employment opportunities. But that's something that I know Harlan's going to do some work on, and I think he has some jobs fairs that are scheduled in the very near future.
Yeah, Mr. Trombley, why don't you think do more Native people go out for these jobs? Or is that even the problem at all, in your opinion?
Well, I guess a lot don't kind of understand, you know, like, especially about corrections. Like, for instance, Wednesday I attended a career fair in Browning at their community college. The booth we had set up there, a lot of the people that came over and talked to us, it was I and a coworker that went to the career fair. Mm-hmm. When they saw Department of Corrections, majority of them thought of prison, you know, correctional officers. Mm. And when we kind of got to talking with them and letting them know, you know, there's other positions within corrections, you know, support staff, IT, legal, medical, mental health, you know, a lot of them didn't know about that. So I think just getting out there, like I said, talking to people and kind of trying to educate them.
Yeah, so maybe Mr. Bautista, just simple marketing, a different approach would help. Yeah,
yeah, I think it will. I think it will, and I think Harlan's points are well made. I think a lot of people don't understand all of the positions that are offered at the Department of Corrections. I think when people think of corrections, they largely think of the prison, and we have challenges in our own right about recruitment and retention at Montana State Prison. It tends to be more of a regional approach because of the way our salaries are. We have a lot of people over at Montana State Prison that commute daily between Butte and Anaconda and Deer Lodge. So yeah. I do think Harlan's right on the money in terms of letting Native American candidates know that there are a lot of different opportunities within this field.
If I can switch gears, Mr. Batista, recently, as you know, the Department of Justice released results of a survey that found a high rate of sexual assault at the state prison. 17 Montana respondents to this reported inmate-on-inmate sexual assaults, 19 reported staff-on-inmate sexual misconduct, and I recall you saying those numbers just don't seem quite right. How come?
Well, we have different numbers that are lower than what is reported in the BJS study. Bureau of Justice Statistics, they're the ones who completed the study. Our numbers, lower numbers than they reported. And the challenge is just that all of the reports by inmates, they were all anonymous, so we don't have enough information to really compare it with the data that we have at Montana State Prison to know whether or not an allegation was credible or unfounded. So it's really difficult to do the comparison to determine if those numbers that were presented in the BJS report are accurate. The ones that we have that have been reported to the prison, we are very confident that those numbers are accurate. So there is some challenges, just the differences of statistical information that's been presented, just knowing some of the circumstances and whether or not they're legitimate complaints.
And again, what are those numbers that have been reported to the prison that you say are accurate?
I don't have them handy, but they were lower than what was reported in the BJS study.
You've said that there were gaps in policies, in procedures when you took over a little over a year ago. What were you referring to? What sort of gaps?
Well, I think one of the things that we've greatly improved on is just refining our procedures in terms of how an inmate can report an allegation, how staff handles it. We're educating the staff about the Prison Rape Elimination Act requirements. We recently hired a new PREA coordinator who spent many years in a leadership position at Montana State Prison, was heavily involved in all of our training efforts. So we feel like we've made up a lot of ground, as have all states that are trying to come compliant with the PREA reporting requirements. So we've really had to kind of standardize and refine how an inmate can report when they report. You know, there's a number of mechanisms. There's a PREA hotline. There's an opportunity to report directly to a staff. There's a grievance procedure. There's sending a kite, the communication that we use within the facility, to a staff member about a sexual assault allegation. So we've kind of refined that. The staff have a better understanding of how that information needs to be shared, not only with our administration, our correctional officers, but also our investigators, to ensure that a proper review is done on a complaint. So we've gotten a lot better at that.
How would you characterize the physical infrastructure at the Montana State Prison right now?
In terms of the campus?
Yeah.
Well, the campus was built a long time ago. I'm drawing a blank exactly on the date of the campus, but there are some challenges in the security line of sight within the facility. One of the things that we did this past session was try and replace one of our aging units at Montana State Prison, and the reason for that is that it doesn't offer adequate line of sight for our correctional officers when viewing inmate activities within that unit. So it's an aged building. There are some challenges in terms of being able to have cameras at all locations to view inmate staff activities. But I think we've made a lot of improvements in some of those things that will help us be able to determine whether or not a complaint is legitimate. If there's a complaint of a sexual assault, some of the audiovisual things, enhancements that we made, I think will help. But it is an older building, and it comes with some unique challenges as a result of that.
And if you wanted to update a little bit, your go-to would be, I guess, the legislature, right?
Yeah. Anytime there's a building project, it is run through the Long Range Building Committee. We brought that up last session. We're in the early process of budget planning for the next session, but that may be an issue. It gives us an opportunity to enhance our security in that particular unit and also maybe to expand our ability to have more beds as well, so that we can much quicker transfer inmates that are classified at a higher, lower level between units.
And last question for both you all. Mr. Trombley, let me start with you. If you had the top two, maybe three priorities for this year, what would they be?
Educating staff, like with their cultural awareness training. Another thing was just, like I said before, just getting out to all the facilities, you know, making myself available, and also working with all the tribal communities too.
Mr. Batista.
Well, the top two priorities I would have is the work that we're doing on offender reentry into communities. I think we're making a lot of progress and have a lot of momentum with the reentry task force that came out of the passage of House Bill 68 during this past legislative session. I think we've got a lot of good groundwork. I think our participation in the study and evaluation of mental illness in correctional facilities is very important to the correctional system, as it is to local law enforcement as well. And then I guess the third, even though you asked me for two, would be pay issues for correctional staff.
And again, that goes back to the legislature, you'd think.
It does. Yeah, it's been, I think some of the pay for some of our positions have been not neglected, but stalled at a certain level for way too long. And we need to pay these people for what is a very difficult, demanding job. We need to pay them the right way.
And boy, you mentioned a mental illness in the correction system. That's a whole nother discussion, but boy, that's a big one, huh?
It is. It's a very big one. And there are a lot of people, I think, including some an interim committee that is doing a lot of good research, having some good deliberations about that issue. And there are some advocacy groups in Montana that have waited a long time to see some of the changes that need to take place in terms of how we treat mentally ill, and people at Department of Corrections feel the same way.
I've been speaking with Montana Department of Corrections Director Mike Batista and Department of Corrections American Indian Liaison Harlan Trombley. Fellas, it was really good to meet both of you and touch base. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Ed.
Thank you.
To hear the first part of our interview with Trombley and Batista, visit mtpr.org. Now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide tonight should be mostly clear with some patchy freezing fog and lows 15 to 22 degrees. Tomorrow should be mostly clear with some patchy freezing fog in the morning. Expect highs in the mid-30s to lower 40s. In central Montana tonight, it should also be mostly clear. Expect lows in the 20s, and wind gusts could be up to 55 miles per hour overnight. Tomorrow should be sunny, then become mostly cloudy over the day, bringing a slight chance of snow. Highs should be 40 to 50 degrees. And in southwest Montana tonight, it should be mostly clear with lows 15 to 25 degrees. Tomorrow should be sunny with highs 35 to 45 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Bruce Farling.
Some politicians clearly don't get irony. They argue vehemently that government is too big, must be pared down, and that it spends too much time and money on things that don't matter. Recently, at the behest of lawmakers of this bent, Montana's legislatively appointed Environmental Quality Council sponsored a session on, well, something that costs time and money and doesn't matter. The council invited a Utah lawmaker to meet with them on how states can demand the federal government hand over Forest Service and BLM lands for state ownership, management, and sale to private interests. Some Montana lawmakers and county commissions are even dedicating official time, pitching arguments, or developing legislation and resolutions to further this crusade. Kooky sagebrush rebellion constitutional theory that the federal government supposedly promised these lands to the states is the inspiration for this scheme, but it's a pipe dream, and it ignores long-settled law regarding the relationship between the federal government, public lands, and states. Plotting how states can capture federal lands is as meaningful as, say, plotting how to capture Bigfoot. The foundation of the state land grab scheme is based on the theory that when states and private interests own federal lands, they produce improved economic benefits from natural resource development. It's also based on the claim that state lands are always managed better than federal lands, and that Montana simply has too much federal land and it's holding us back. History and the numbers refute that, however. When Montana became a territory in 1864, all 93 million acres were in the federal domain. But the 1862 Homestead Act immediately changed that as thousands of Easterners made 160-plus acre claims for their piece of Montana. Then Congress created the scandalously corrupt land-grant system for railroads. In 1865, more than 44 million acres of the public domain in the Northwest was ceded to the Northern Pacific Railroad alone, including 17 million acres in Montana. Handing federal lands to the railroads was supposed to generate great economic wealth for the territory, but it mainly created wealth for robber barons. Eventually, these tracts and subsequent railroad land grants were controlled in a dizzying array of Gilded Age deals that invoked the names of Jim Hill, J.P. Morgan, and John D. Rockefeller, leading to eventual control and unsustainable logging by the Anaconda Company, as well as more recently the St. Regis Timber Company, Champion International, Stimson Lumber, and of course, a direct spawn of the railroad monopolies, Plum Creek. That's why the private interest owned many of the western Montana's best timber-growing sites in a checkerboard pattern. In addition, the general mining laws of 1865 and 1872 have allowed miners to patent or gain title to other significant chunks of federal land, and to do so in recent times at 19th century prices. Not all these lands have been mined. Many are now private recreational enclaves surrounded by federal land. Further, upon statehood, Montana was granted 5.1 million acres of the federal domain, more than five times the amount of acres in Glacier National Park, to be used as trust lands, with the principal purpose not being conservation, but to be developed to maximize revenue for schools and other state interests. Over the last 150 years, nearly three-quarters of the original federal domain in Montana has been given to private interests, the state, or Indian tribes. In addition, thanks to reallocation schemes in the Federal Dawes Act and other laws, the federal government and state by 1938 had helped facilitate the transfer to non-tribal interests more than 90 million acres of land formerly vested to Montana's Indian tribes by treaty. You would then think these huge transfers of federal and tribal lands in Montana to the state and private interests over the years would have been sufficient to support economic development for the state's small population. They include the best agricultural land, the best commercial timber growing sites, and the best and most accessible mineral finds. But some people apparently need it all. It is patently silly to contend that the 75% of the original federal domain transferred to private, state, and tribal hands is not good enough for our economic well-being, especially when considering that the 25% or so still held by the Forest Service, BLM, and Park Service is already managed for natural resource development, recreation, or watershed protection. The only thing sillier is wasting time and public resources arguing for an ideological pipe dream. This is Bruce Farling of Montana Trout Unlimited. Contact us at www.montanatu.org.
Bruce Farling is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.